Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with former UPR student reporters who've gone on to great things. Our guests will include Amy Van Tatenhove, who was a UPR science reporter, is now a Rose postdoctoral fellow at Cornell University. Later in the program, Clarissa Casper, former UPR Salt Lake Tribune Cache Valley reporter and current Rachel Carson science journalism fellow at Cornell. And we hope to be joined by Ellis Julin as well, former UPR science reporter and current environmental reporter with Montana Public Radio. And we bring on right now Amy Van Tatenhove. Amy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So want to jump in and see what you're doing now. You were one of our science reporters at Utah Public Radio, right? Ecology Center, where we have doctoral students doing our reporting.
Yeah, I finished my PhD in 2024. It seems like a long time ago, but I was in Utah working for Utah Public Radio, had a fantastic time, and now I'm out in New York.
Yeah, at Cornell.
Yep.
So your bio says you're a quantitative ecologist, scrolling down here, you describe your work. My research is focused on understanding avian population trends and dynamics in response to global change. How are species faring across space and time? So quantitative ecologist, tell me about that.
Yeah, sure. So this is sort of a path I've been moving along for a while that really started during my PhD at Utah State. But basically what I do is I crunch numbers. I spend a lot of time behind the computer and I use data collected by people across North America and basically use that information to figure out what avian populations are doing, whether they're declining or increasing and why, whether that's, you know, low adult survival, or they're just not producing chicks, or, you know, kind of understanding what's going on behind those population trends.
So you say you use eBird data. What's eBird?
That is a very good question. So eBird is one of the flagship things that have come out of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And basically it's this app that you download on your phone and you go out and you listen and look for birds and then you record what you see. And all that, so it's part of a community science project or citizen science project that, you know, takes all this information. And from that, we can figure out, how many birds are in an area, what species. And it's expanded globally. So we have information from across the globe, including Antarctica, the middle of the ocean where people are on ships. It's really impressive. It's really cool to work with.
So these are regular folks getting this data.
Yep. Yeah. Anybody. People who have never paid attention to birds before, people who are, you know, hardcore ornithologists. It's, you know, all kind of included in there. And there's a lot of stuff going on in the background that the Lab of Ornithology does to make sure that the data is usable for scientists like myself. It's open to anyone.
So you say it included people on ships. So you get, I guess, data from just about anywhere.
Yeah, literally anywhere. There's a really cool map. I'm not exactly sure where you can find it specifically, but if you Google it, you can see there's information about where all the eBird data come from. And you can see there's all these lines that go across the ocean where people are submitting eBird checklists of seabirds that they've seen. So it's pretty astounding.
I recall, at least here, you were studying pelicans.
Yeah.
Are you still doing that?
Not directly. So I'm still working on publishing some of my doctoral work. So there will be maybe another paper or two out that I've authored on pelican research. But now I'm just working with mostly songbird data. You know, things in eastern forests just coming from eBird.
Yeah.
So far cry from pelicans.
Yeah. So pelicans, you go out to the Great Salt Lake. Songbirds. I noticed you had one paper where you went to Prince Edward Island. That's good work if you get it.
Yeah, I didn't actually go to the island.
Oh, but, you didn't? Okay. Oh,
no,
that's sad. Yeah.
I've heard it's beautiful.
Yes.
But I did talk to somebody who worked there did a little interview for them. So that was really fun.
Yeah. Changing climate brings pros and cons to PEI's birds and those who watch them. Tell me a little bit about this.
Basically, it was just an interview by one of the reporters at one of the local newspapers there. But yeah, basically, it was just they're interested in hearing about how climate change is driving species to move around, why they're being impacted. So especially for somewhere like Prince Edward Island, they've seen a lot of flooding and impacts on the shorebirds. And yeah, just changes to the forest too.
Are you study birds? Are you a birder as well?
I'm maybe not as good of a birder as I would hope to be. I spend a lot of time behind the computer and not a lot of time out in nature, unfortunately. But I'm trying to do better. I'm pretty familiar with all the species around where I live right now. But trying to go out more and take some time to be out in nature instead of just in the office.
You're crunching data. That's important, right? So tell me a little bit more about what you do, what kind of data you're using, what you're trying to accomplish.
We already talked about eBird. So I'm using data from eBird, which gives us information on abundance. So basically how many birds we think are in an area based on species. So that's one component, and of course that's coming through the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. So that's housed right where I'm at. But I'm also using bird banding data, which is outside of Cornell. And the bird banding or birds are banded across the world, but specifically I'm using data from North America, which is part of this program called Monitoring Avian Productivity and Survivorship. But basically, it's going out and capturing birds and putting a little identification bands on them, and then people catch them later, and they can see where they were banded, where they've moved, how long they've survived. That gives us information on adult survival and things like that need to go into the work that I'm doing.
I wanted to talk about a few of the articles that are on your website. By the way, it's avantatenhove.com. That's where you can find Ava Van Tatenhove. Well, I think I found this here, a paper article called The Importance of Stupidity in Scientific Research. I have to hear about this.
So I unfortunately was not part of that research. That was just I have a page up that's some resources that I think are important for people to know about. And yeah, I think sort of summing that up in a nutshell is I feel like as scientists we're very focused on sounding smart and knowing feeling like we know everything. Sometimes it's really important to ask what we think are dumb questions. And, basically it's like, we don't always understand the things that are underlying, these big ideas. And we think we do, but, if we ask these questions, like very basic questions, like, well, what about this? And then, that opens up either a whole new avenue of research or, a whole new understanding of, or a new paradigm, I guess, of different kinds of research or, how to apply things or how to involve more communities, and just, have more of a wholesome understanding of the world that we're operating in. And yeah, it's fun to just explore things. And, I think we need to, let our hair down a little bit as scientists sometimes. So yeah, we can be stupid and have fun and kind of, just take chances on things. So yeah, that's kind of what that's all about.
Have you used that? Have you put that into to practice?
It is surprisingly hard to do that because we're
Okay.
trained to be so focused and so, top knowledge base for our or expertise for our areas. But yeah, I think I'm trying to like be more chill about my research and just have fun. It's kind of what science is supposed to be, even though it doesn't always come out that way.
So that can I imagine that could be hard in at least one respect that I can think of. I've been around professors for my career. I'm not a professor, but a little bit familiar with the polite knife fighting that I describe, that the thrust and parry, right? Review of your the arguments back and forth,
Oof.
Which would seem to be antithetical to admitting dumb questions. But I guess you can do it even in that world.
Yeah. It is very difficult, and I think things are changing a little bit. I think we're getting at least the spheres that I work in, we're getting a lot more relaxed about kind of how we do things, and like kind of trying to break out of our ivory tower type thing, as people put it. But yeah, there are definitely people who are very pedantic and very hard to work with. But at the same time, there's some really, really fantastic collaborators I've worked with who are just interested in, understanding what's going on in the world and working with people and, bringing about change. So it's slowly changing, I think. We're getting a little bit better at not being so, I don't know, snooty, I guess.
Yeah, and to all the professors I'm friends with, I'm not talking about you, so don't come after me. So you say on your website, communicating science to the public is important to you. As you've gone out, of course, you worked in that when you were at Utah Public Radio, and as you've gone out to postdoc now and preparing for this career in this field. Are you seeing sonic communication skills among the professionals increasing or decreasing, or are you seeing that out there? Are you still seeing a lot of jargony stuff?
It's kind of a mix of both, and I think we're getting better. I've been seeing a lot more opportunities to learn like how to do science communication. Yeah, at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, we have a lot of great people who like their sole job is to communicate the science that we do. So that's very exciting. But yeah, I think there's still a lot of difficulty in translating like the science that we do to the public, just because. Some of the stuff is very jargony. I'm working on integrated population models with very specific statistics that kind of underlie the whole thing, and that's hard to translate. A lot of people do genetics stuff that is also very hard to translate to the general public. But I think we're getting a better understanding of the tidbits that we should be sharing that make sense to the public who may not have a science background. So yeah, I feel like there's definitely progress, but we still need to be doing a lot better and understanding how we can share this with the public or get that audience reach, which is always a struggle, because people don't want to hear about genetics at 8 a.m. It's a bit much, but we're getting there.
Yeah. By the way, we're at in the 9 o'clock hour mountain time, so I guess we could talk genetics. Here, but if you're in California, don't listen in. Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah.
What are some other factors in communicating with the public? I imagine this is where stupidity would come in as well. Not calling the public stupid, but thinking of questions that maybe you have long since answered for yourself, but the public may not know the answers to.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really good point. And I think, thinking about like, or I think it's really, really important to put yourself in the shoes of non-scientists. And I think that's something that we really struggle with as scientists. We have this perspective that, everybody knows the science, they should understand it. And, we're, a very small subset of the population who are, very literate in science. And I think it's really important to, speak to the common denominator, sort of like, people who don't have a background in science or people who are, maybe not even, at least from, my work, not interested in birds, or, you find those little hooks that bring them in. And I think some of us are very, very bad at doing that. They just expect people like to know or to understand that this stuff is important. And we really need to learn how to demonstrate that to the general public. And yeah, just, speaking to the public is, kind of on their level, not in the very specific areas that we focus on, I think is very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever gone into, an inquiry, a paper, whatever, based on a question you've gotten from the public?
I actually, well, not the public specifically. I worked a lot with Department of Natural Resources and Wildlife Resources in Utah. So more questions that they were interested in. But I think there definitely have been papers published on inquiries from the public that I think have been really impactful. There's a lot of stuff to do with bioacoustics or how can we how can we identify birds with sound, or things sort of that realm, or I feel like I'm seeing a lot more hummingbirds at my feeder in the winter, which is unusual. And then there's been a huge area of study that's blossomed from that. So I think, yeah, listening to that's another really good point. Listening to the public is really helpful too, because we can, generate these questions that as scientists we never would have thought of.
You have on your website, you have a couple of YouTube shorts. I guess this is something you've done periodically, field work, right?
Yes.
I guess you've kind of right now you're sort of more on data, but field work. One of these Card Canyon snowshoeing. I don't know if you remember this one. I don't know how recent that was.
Yes. Yeah, so oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask you about that. Tell me about that.
Sure. So yeah, well, this all started, I was working in New Hampshire, back in, I believe it was 20, I think I started doing this in 2018. I was leading a crew that we would just go around in the forest and listen to birds and count the birds and figure out what species they were, and collect data on that. And basically, we had to walk alone in the forest for a long time. And so I got really bored, and I started filming what I was doing. So I'd walk around and say, "Okay, it's 6 a.m. I'm very sleepy, but we're listening to this kind of bird, or there's this really hard place to hike through. This is why I'm doing it," and just sort of sharing some of the science. And then I kept doing that, and I had a lot of fun doing it. And then, I moved to Utah for my PhD, and then the pandemic hit, so I had a lot of time on my hands. So I continued doing this a little bit, and I started expanding some of these videos to some of the, things I did around Logan. So like hiking up Card Canyon. I actually think of snowshoeing. And just sort of sharing like, this is a beautiful area. This is why I'm here. I totally recommend going out here. This is what you'll see. I also did one for one of the mines in the area. I think it was, I can't remember the name of the mine, but anyway, sort of a little tour of the mine and things like that. So just sharing what I was seeing. But unfortunately, those videos take a long time to put together. So I haven't had time to do much of that recently, but maybe in the future.
Well, that's maybe should be part of a scientist's repertoire, right? Direct connection with the public.
Yeah, and I think, given how much time we spend working on our jobs and thinking about our research, it's not doable for everyone, unfortunately. It'd be so cool to, have every scientist share a little bit about what they're doing. But I think we're also getting better as at least like in a broader sense, like universities are doing a very good job of, putting out social media posts about, different people's research and contacting scientists to say, "Hey, would you be willing to sit for a short interview that we can share on Instagram or whatever?" So I think we're getting better at that. But yeah, it's unfortunately very time consuming, and it's hard to balance, the outreach and the science and, it's planning for field work and what else, you have, and, having a life on the side. It's a lot.
Right, having a life on the side, yeah, that's important.
Yep.
This next question is gonna make me sound like a Luddite, but I'll venture anyway, an alarmist. I wonder if you share a concern. It seems like not just young people, it seems like people in general are shorter and shorter attention spans. I find it, even myself, I'm affected. I go to YouTube and I gravitate toward the shorts. I'll see something that looks interesting. I'll look at the time, 10 minutes. Oh no, that's way too much time. I want to find something that'll give the information in 1 minute. I'm relating that to science. I wonder if that's especially up and coming scientists or people consuming science. You've got to spend a little bit of time, even in that media, to set it up, right? It seems like maybe it's going in the wrong direction.
Yeah, I think definitely our attention spans largely, are getting shorter. And, myself, I definitely see that. I definitely gravitate toward that, quick fix, on social media or doom scrolling or whatever. And, I don't know if how that's affecting science or how that's affecting scientists. I know that I definitely have to or had to spend a lot of time teaching myself how to focus. And, I still struggle with that, and I'm sure I'm not the only one. But yeah, I think translating science to the public, that's also a huge struggle because people don't want to read a paper. People don't want to read even like a one-page PDF, informational, booklet or whatever. It's all needs to be visual, it needs to be catchy, it needs to be short. So I think yeah, there's a real struggle translating these really complex science ideas to the public just because one, we need them to, or we need something that will, bring them in and hook them. And then it's got to be short, but also true. We can't simplify it to the point where it's not actually real anymore. So it's definitely a struggle. And yeah, it's as somebody who consumes science, as, through science communication as well, like that's, I don't want to listen to a 10-minute video. I want to see that quick infographic and be done with it. So yeah, it's a challenging landscape for sure.
So you say you taught yourself to focus. What did you do?
Basically, so there. This is going to sound very nerdy, but there are different methods out there that one of my favorites is called the Pomodoro method. And basically, you set a timer for I think 5 minutes, and you just make yourself work on something. And after that 5 minutes is up, then your brain has kind of switched to that task, and it's like, oh, okay, I can keep going. And then you work for a certain amount of time, and then you check in. Okay, like, do I want to keep working? Do I need a break? If you want to keep working, then you just keep focusing, and it's a lot easier to get started on something because it's more of like a bite-sized chunk. But then once you get set on that topic, once you're focused, then it's easier to just keep going. You have that kind of inertia that keeps you focused. So yeah, that's sort of what I've used, and it definitely helps. But I still struggle with focus sometimes.
Well, let's focus next as we head toward a break on our UPR spring fund drive. I don't know how that was for a segue, but it'll have to do. We're talking with Amy Van Tatenhove, who is a UPR science reporter, now a Rose postdoctoral fellow at Cornell University. We're talking with her later in the program. We'll be bringing in Clarissa Casper, former UPR Salt Lake Tribune Cache Valley reporter and current Rachel Carson science journalism fellow at Cornell. By the way, do you run into Clarissa out there?
I do. We work in the same building.
Oh,
So
okay,
when I
great.
found out, yeah, I found out that she was going to move to Cornell, and we met up for lunch, and I see her around all the time. So it's great to see her.
Yeah, a couple of USU grads. Yeah. So it is the UPR Spring Fund Drive. We are looking for your support right now in whatever amount to support great programs like Access Utah. This is listener supported, and we are looking for your support, especially in this post-rescission world. We have lost our biggest monthly sustainer, you might call them that, the federal government, $200,000 a year. So can you kick in just a little bit extra? Can you become a monthly sustainer to Utah Public Radio? We're looking for that support today at 800-826-1495. Or upr.org, upr.org. So, Amy, part of what people are supporting when they support UPR is the great reporting, especially by the science reporters, the way you were. I wonder what you felt you gained from that time at UPR.
I gained a lot more. Well, when I applied for the job, I thought I would gain, some science communication skills, which I did. But I also gained a lot more than I ever expected. That was, understanding how to listen to people, understanding how to connect to people, understanding how to share stories that, are kind of outside of my realm of knowledge. And I really felt connected to Utah, which, I'm not originally from Utah, so that it was really an amazing experience, and I miss it a lot. It was very, very uplifting, and it was challenging and just a whole lot of fun.
That's what public media can do. It can really connect you, as you say, Amy, not from Utah, but helped you connect to Utah.
I learned things about Logan. I've learned things about Utah that I never would have learned otherwise, and I feel much richer for it.
So join your support with Amy's, with mine, with all those who participated so far in the spring fun drive. We are making our way toward the goal. The drive ends on Friday. We have increased our goal, overall goal for the drive, because we need that extra money and with the loss of federal funding. The good news is you don't have to make up all of that. We pool our resources. That's what we do here to Utah Public Radio. It is a community in all the best ways. And I really appreciate that. If you appreciate that as well, join your support with mine and with others who are giving in this so far successful. We want to continue that to drive. And just jump on board. The best way to do that is a monthly sustaining membership. That means just money comes in automatically from you to UPR monthly and regularly. And in that way, we can see what we have coming in monthly, and we can make our decisions accordingly. If you can kick in a little extra, that would be very, very helpful. Like I say, we've lost our biggest sustainer, the federal government. Perhaps you're inching closer to being a member of the producer circle. That means $100 a month. We'd love to have you come on board at that leadership level. Whatever the amount, we are looking for your support right now, and I'm hoping to see support for Access Utah, taking that personally in the best ways. UPR.org, UPR.org is the place to go, UPR.org. We'll have more following this break.
On the next Living on Earth, old-growth mother trees and their importance for forest ecosystems.
You know, an old tree never really dies, right? Yeah, I mean, the individual passes on, but that dispersal of energy to the next generations or even to the soil food web, it's alive.
I'm Steve Curwood, discovering the wisdom of the forest next time on Living on Earth from PRX.
Wednesday at 10, here on Utah Public Radio during our spring fundraising drive.
It's mandolin virtuoso, Rhonda Vincent. She's telling road tales of her family bluegrass band, getting to the Grand Ole Opry, then Montreal-born singer Alison Russell on her journey to healing through music, plus words from Nina Simone, Sister Rosetta Tharpe, Lucinda Williams, and Johnny Cash. On American Roots from PRX.
Tune in Saturday evening at 8 here on UPR.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're highlighting former UPR student interns who have gone on to great things. Later in the program, we'll be talking with Clarissa Casper, former UPR Salt Lake Tribune Cache Valley reporter, current Rachel Carson Science Journalism Fellow at Cornell. Right now, we're talking with a former UPR science reporter, Amy Van Tatenhove, who's now a Rose Postdoctoral Fellow at Cornell University. So Amy Van Tatenhove, another 7 or 8 minutes here in this conversation. I'd like to do maybe a couple of quick hits, just some articles you have on your website that were fascinating to me. I wonder if you could just give me some quick explanations here. One, this just really struck me, the headline, Why Do Birds Migrate and When? What to Know About Bird Migration. Why do birds, that's a big question, why do birds migrate?
That is a very good question that has been debated by scientists for many years. So there's a couple different theories, but basically what the general consensus is that it's to follow resources. If you're a bird in the tropics, there are a lot of resources there, but you have a lot of people or a lot of other species that you're competing with. And so if you can migrate somewhere in the summer when you need more resources to raise your chicks and, get more body fat and kind of keep yourself healthy. Migrating to those abundant resources that, are seasonal, like they are here in New York and Utah, then you can really capitalize on those resources. And then you have abundant food to feed your chicks. You have abundant food for yourself during the breeding season. And then when that all goes away, when it gets cold, you migrate back to the tropics and you spend your winter as a snowbird. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. And how birds decide where to migrate and when to migrate really depends on species. But there's some birds that don't migrate at all. They just spend their time sitting in the snow up in Logan Canyon. And then there are some that, migrate thousands and thousands of miles. And, like I said, it depends on the species and why they migrate, when they migrate, where they migrate to. But it's all very complex.
Yeah, later in the hour, my conversation with Clarissa Casper, we'll talk with her about birds migrating at night. I didn't know they did that, but she'll tell us about a study where people better able to count, better able to study that. But that's something I wasn't realizing. At nighttime, we got birds flying overhead. Here's an article I want to have you talk with me briefly about. Climate heat extremes are driving tropical bird declines. Tell me about this.
A lot of there's been a lot of focus on climate change and how that impacts birds, of course, and wildlife in general and people and everything in the world. But there was a recent article that came out I think last year that it looked at these heat extremes. So generally, we've been looking at the average temperatures increasing or landscape or farmland and whatever converting to things that birds can't use. And so it was interesting that this group, I wasn't a part of the research, but this group that focused on these climate extremes and how those impact birds, and they found that heat, really intense heat, actually causes a lot more problems for birds, at least of the population that they studied in the tropics, which is really concerning because we're seeing more of these heat extremes hitting globally areas. Like in the West, we've seen really, really hot temperatures already. Out here in New York, we've seen wild temperature fluctuations. All of that really, really affects wildlife. And so, yeah, these extremes, I think they found are really, really causing problems for species where, they're just kind of reaching those physiological tolerances where they just can't really feed anymore. They can't get enough water. They just can't really survive. And that's all unfortunately slated to get worse as climate change intensifies.
Maybe one more here is from you find these art links these articles at your website, atatenhove.com. We're talking about Amy Tatenhove. This one was fascinating to me. How do seabirds drink salt water? I didn't know they did. Subheadline: albatrosses, petrels, other ocean dwellers stay hydrated without fresh water. So how do seabirds drink salt water?
Yeah, this is a really interesting area of research. And yeah, you think if you go to the ocean and you drink a cup of salt water, like one, tastes terrible. And two, that's gonna suck all the water out of your cells and whatever and make you thirstier, which is not a good thing. So yeah, but seabirds, a lot of them can straight up drink salt water. And it's really interesting because they have it's this weird gland that's kind of behind their eyes. I think it's in different places on different species, but in a lot of species, it's behind their eyes and it actually excretes salt. So it concentrates salt from the water that they drink and then it excretes it out their nose. And you'll see on some of these albatrosses and sometimes even gulls, they'll just have this little drip of water at the end of their beak. And that's that concentrated salt water that's coming out of those glands. So yeah, they're very well adapted to living on the ocean. And like I said, they can just straight up drink salt water. There are some species too that don't have those glands, but they can still, survive in these pretty salty environments, but their kidneys have evolved to concentrate salt. So there's a couple different ways that they do it, but the seabirds have that gland for the most part.
Yeah, fascinating. Just a couple of minutes left here. Amy, tell me what you're working on again. What are you studying?
Like I was explaining before, I'm a quantitative ecologist, and basically what I'm doing is taking different data sources and using that information to understand how bird populations are faring across North America. Are their populations going up or down? And then trying to understand why, specifically from a demographic standpoint. So is adult survival causing populations to go down, or are they not producing enough chicks to keep the population stable, or are the chicks just not surviving? Kind of, what's underlying those population trends? And yeah, I sit behind the computer a lot and use a lot of data. So unfortunately, I'm not collecting the data myself anymore. But yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
Well, that's great. We've been talking with Amy Van Tatenhove, who is currently a Rose postdoctoral fellow at Cornell University, formerly UPR science reporter. So once again, UPR Spring Fun Drive. Amy, what do you get from public radio? Why should you think people should support it?
Oh, yeah, so much. So I listen to my local station here in upstate New York a lot. And it's really, you know, it's a news source that is local, which is super important. So you can, you know, be connected to your local, you know, communities, understand what's going on. And, you know, it's also a trustworthy news source. And, you know, I found this for all of the, you know, public news outlets that I've listened to or read. You know, it's just really, really nice to know that what you're getting is important, is impactful, and is real, and, you know, is connected to your community. So all of that wrapped in one.
Yeah, very, very important words, right? Impactful, connected to community. All of that is very true. And that's why I give. That's why I give to Utah Public Radio. I feel a real sense of community. It is a strong community. I love being part of it. Love the trustworthy news, all the information, entertainment as well that I receive from Utah Public Radio. And love being part of this Access Utah community as well. So you're supporting the science reporting. Amy Van Tietenhove got her start here in public radio world as a science reporter at Utah Public Radio. You're supporting all the great conversations on Access Utah. You're supporting Wild About Utah. All of it. Supported with just one simple visit to our website, upr.org. Click on the green donate button, upr.org. That's upr.org. Give whatever you can. And in this post-precision world, loss of federal funding, maybe consider giving just a little bit more. Monthly automatic contribution is the very best. So look at that on our website, upr.org. But just the fact that you go there or go to call 800-826-1495, upr.org, upr.org, will make a huge, huge difference. And while you're thinking about it right now, we hope that you'll take care of that. upr.org, upr.org. Well, Amy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom. This has been so much fun.
Thank you. Appreciate that. We'll go to break. When we come back, we'll be talking with another former reporter for UPR, Clarissa Casper, who's, coincidentally enough, also at Cornell at this point. More following this break.
As six women forge a lifelong friendship at a beauty salon, one of them decides to risk everything to start a family.
Diabetics have healthy babies all the time.
You are special. There are limits to what you can do.
Frances Fisher, Brittany Snow, and Amy Pete Starr in Steel Magnolias by Robert Harling. Next time on LA Theater Works.
Tune in Friday night at 9 here on UPR.
Programming support here on Utah Public Radio comes from our members and Cafe Ibis, 52 Federal Avenue in historic downtown Logan. Open 7 days a week, featuring triple-certified bird-friendly coffee, espresso bar, beans, brewing tools, and many gift options. Information and ordering at cafeibis.com.
You're listening to Access Utah, and in this hour, we're featuring some great former UPR reporters. And we turn next to Clarissa Casper, who was a reporter for UPR, also Cache Valley reporter for Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. And now, Clarissa is Rachel Carson Science Journalism Fellow at Cornell. Clarissa, so great to talk to you.
Yeah, it's great to be back on air with you.
So what are you doing? I guess we'd start there at Cornell. What are you doing there?
Yeah, so I'm the very first Rachel Carson Science Journalism Fellow at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, which is the bird lab up at Cornell. That's one of the biggest nonprofits in bird science in the world. And so here I do a lot of different journalism duties. I write for Living Bird magazine. I write for the Cornell Chronicle. I write for allaboutbirds.org. I also write press releases. I kind of sit in on strategic communication relations meetings. I get to help design the magazine. I also mentor undergraduate writers. So I hire science writers who also kind of help with these things. And I'm their editor and their mentor. So I also help edit their pieces, help assign stories. And then I also just started teaching a science journalism course at Cornell on Monday, where I teach about 8 students about science journalism and have them work toward writing an article about birds. So I do a lot of different things up here, but journalism is still kind of the main focus.
So in your bio for Cornell, you say you help make complex research accessible and engaging for broad audiences. How do you do that?
Yeah, it's so I'm not a scientist myself. I have a little bit of background in biology because I did my first year in biology before I did journalism, but I basically do it by making scientists explain it to me in a way that's understandable for me. So I know that if it's understandable to me, it's likely understandable to another person who's not a bird scientist or a scientist in general. So a lot of that is having scientists, you know, restate things and ask them follow-up questions that are like, you know, could you maybe explain that to me as if I was your, you know, second grader? And things like that to try and get the complex information dumbed down, not dumbed down, but, you know, whittled down to like the most interesting and understandable part of it. I also really like to like put science into like scenarios that are everyday scenarios that people might encounter. So like try and frame issues in things that everyday people do or things that everyday people are interested in, and then try and pull them into the science more, if that makes sense. So yeah, it's a lot of just making things understandable to myself, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
In this bio, you say, I want to have you tell the story. When you were 17, you fell in love with humpback whales and puffins. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so when I was 17, a senior in high school, I saved up every penny I had working at a senior center to go to Grand Manan Island on the east coast of Canada, which is in the Bay of Fundy, which is where tons of humpback whales are during the summer, and puffins. And I wanted to go there because I had always wanted to see whales. I'd always wanted to see puffins specifically. And I went there and I got to go out whale watching a bunch of times. And I got to go to this island, Machias Seal Island. It's off the coast of Maine. That's a puffin breeding colony island. And that experience completely transformed my life. I was super inspired to see animals in the wild like that, to see birds, in such unique birds. Gathering on an island together. And ever since that moment, I wanted to do something with birds or with whales or with biodiversity and wildlife.
You wrote, I was reading an op-ed piece in the Salt Lake Tribune that you wrote in, I think this was 2022 or 2023. The headline of here on the story is Bird Conservation Starts with Individual Engagement. And you talked about, I hadn't heard this phrase before. You said at a certain point before you became a birder, you were bird blind. What is that?
Yeah, bird blind is what I use to describe people who, you know, there's birds everywhere. You could go outside Utah Public Radio right now and look up and you could probably see some robins. You could see some European starlings. But there's people who go about their day who don't like realize how many birds are around. And I was one of those people, even despite being somebody who loves animals and loves birds. I guess I hadn't truly understood like how many birds are around me at all times and how many different kinds there are. So I think that a lot of people exist in this bird blindness area, just where they're not. Once you know the birds that are around and you can name them, you're so much more aware and open to it.
You mentioned in this piece, Cache Valley icon, UPR friend Jack Green. I guess he's an example to you of longtime birder, lover of nature as well.
Oh yes, Jack Green. Jack Green really. I see him as a natural mentor of mine. He took me birding many times up in Cache Valley when I was there. Yeah, he's a big inspiration to a lot of people locally in the bird community up there. We actually also did the Intermountain Migratory Bird Survey multiple times together up at Salt Creek Wildlife Management Area. Yeah, Jack Green's the best.
So bird conservation starts with individual engagement. So you bird counts, that kind of thing. Is that what you're talking about? How best to engage, I guess I'm asking.
Yeah. So actually, a big way I started getting involved in bird conservation is actually through the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, even before I ever showed up here, because they have these amazing tools for everyday people to participate in science. So they have eBird, where you can go out and count the birds that you see, identify the species and log them. And that data actually gets implemented into the larger eBird database, and which captures bird sightings from around the world globally. And it allows people who maybe aren't scientists to participate in the science. And there's also Merlin, which is a bird identification app that does kind of the same things, but it allows you to really name the birds around you by identifying them through AI. And I think that is what I was trying to getting at in that piece, was that the more that you engage with birds and know them, and you can name them, and you're less bird blind, the more you are attuned to what's going on with birds. And that kind of happened to me. It's once I started using those apps, I started learning more about, you know, the negative things happening with birds worldwide and how many of them are dying off. And it kind of just sparked this whole trajectory that I'm on now. So, yeah.
What does that do to you, connecting to nature, seeing bird, you know, birding, I guess, all of that? What does that do for you?
That's a good question. I think I was thinking about this yesterday when I was out birding. I think it's just a way to really slow down. Like, I think in our lives and in this, you know, fast-paced world, we're on social media, we're always consuming things, we're always trying to do our best, we're always going to work or going to school and getting things done. But bird watching and birding is just a way to, like, you have to be patient, you have to be still, you have to be quiet. And so it does a lot of those calming things for me. It's almost like a meditation or like mindfulness. You have to be quiet, you have to sit with the sounds of nature, and you can't be impatient. You have to wait for the birds to come to you. So I think it, like, it helps you practice a lot of those things.
You say that you love connecting people with natural world through storytelling, help inspire curiosity and care for birds and biodiversity. So you've done that a lot of different ways and continue to do that different ways, right? Reporting, right? Teaching journalists upcoming, writing creative nonfiction as well.
Yeah. I've done some creative nonfiction writing about nature, I've done magazine. I tried to do that at Utah Public Radio. I tried to connect Cache Valley's local community to nature and the things going on. So, yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious about, I just went looking for some stories that you'd written there at Cornell. One that really struck me, here's the headline: study reveals new technique to identify individual night flying birds for the first time. I guess previous to this breakthrough, you could do radar, which would give you a mass of birds, or, you know, you could do acoustics, which would only pick up birds that call out to each other during the night. But I guess there are migrations happening at night. So tell me about this new science.
Yeah, so this is a really cool study that just came out. It was the idea of Tom Johnson, who is an ornithologist who passed away recently, who was a big Cornell graduate and all of that. But it was really cool because before he passed away, he kind of was experimenting with using thermal monoculars and super bright flashlights to see if he could photograph birds migrating at night, because bird scientists who study night migration have largely always understood that a vast majority of birds migrate silently at night. So they don't understand, they can understand, you know, with radar, how big bursts of birds migrating at night and numbers, but they can't identify individual species. And so in Cape May, they went out during 2020 to 2022 and deployed this idea where you go out with a thermal monocular, which can like scope out like the heat signature of a bird. And then once you see a bird, you know, you're with a partner and you say, oh, I got my eye on one. The other person shines the flashlight and then another person takes a picture. And so they were able to do this in Cape May over a couple of autumn migration seasons. And they were able to take pictures of birds that like they didn't even think migrated at night, or birds that they didn't even think migrated. So for example, red-bellied woodpeckers, there's not much known about how they migrate, or if like they're often thought of that they don't migrate, but they got pictures of red-bellied woodpeckers migrating at night. They got pictures of northern cardinals migrating at night, which is another bird that's like, we didn't know that they migrated at night. So this new technique and this method to photograph birds at night, which they were able to photograph birds at night before, but this is photographing like really them migrating in the sky at night. It can lead to a lot more discoveries about bird migration and night migration that weren't previously understood. It was a really cool story. And Tom Johnson, his colleagues, after he passed away, he didn't get to finish the paper, but his colleagues, they finished it up for him and they pushed it forward across the finish line. And so it's a really inspiring story. I loved doing that one.
Yeah, poignant part of that as well, right? The colleagues picked it up and carried it forward after his death. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're just near the end of the time for this segment. We're in our fun drive here. Tell me a little bit about what your time at UPR did for you.
Yeah, my time at UPR really shaped who I am today and like really helped me grow into the reporter that I am today. I loved my job at UPR. I loved the community in Cache Valley. UPR gave me a lot of skills with connecting with the community and really getting to understand a community on a deep level. And it also gave me a lot of great audio skills, interviewing skills. I think that a lot of the reasons that I'm here today are because of UPR. It also, UPR allowed me to report on things that I wanted to and the things I was interested in, and supported like my passions, which is a big reason I'm here today, because you know, birds are a huge part of my passion, and UPR supported that along the way. So, yeah, UPR is the best, and I miss you guys a lot.
Well, we miss you as well, but we're proud of you, the inaugural Rachel Carson Science Journalism Fellow there at Cornell. So thanks for taking some time with us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Clarissa Casper on Access Utah. And you are listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and as you heard right there, it's the Spring Fun Drive at Utah Public Radio. Just a quick word to remind you that this is a listener-supported radio, and we're looking for your support at upr.org, upr.org. Click on the green donate button. When you tune into UPR, you're not just hearing the headlines, you're getting the full story, and that depth is what sets UPR apart. And quality journalism requires time, resources, and most importantly, support from listeners like you who value this kind of reporting, like the reporting that Clarissa and Amy did while they were here, like the wonderful student interns are doing right now, along with our current UPR Salt Lake Tribune Cache Valley reporter, Brock Marchant. You help to pay for all of that with your donation, your gift right now to upr.org. That's upr.org. I'm suggesting maybe you consider joining the UPR Producer Circle. That's just one level. If you're maybe close to that, can do that. That would be very impactful. You join the monthly, join the UPR Producer Circle, but with a monthly gift of $100. So $1,200 for the year. That's our leadership circle, and that really goes a long way. Whatever level you come in at, we're happy with that. But maybe consider the UPR Producer Circle, $100 a month. With that, you get some day sponsorship announcements. You get access to some exclusive events that we do every once in a while here at UPR. And anybody who comes in at $20 a month has an opportunity to have 5 trees planted in the Amazon rainforest in your honor. This is a great way to impact the climate, a wonderful gift for good. So you not only have that done in your name, but you'll receive a digital certificate, GPS coordinates, and a link to track your trees as they grow over time. Check out all of the options at upr.org, upr.org. And we hope that you will give that monthly sustaining donation now to support Access Utah and everything you hear on Utah Public Radio. upr.org, that's upr.org. And thank you.